The opinions voiced in this podcast are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine which strategies or investments may be suitable for you, consult the appropriate qualified professional prior to making a decision. I'm Hank Stoltz, and this is the podcast of ClearPath Financial Partners. Ryan Kittredge with us, Molly Brown with us as well, and we're going to be talking today about trusts. And this is sort of a, and Ryan, Molly, as always, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Molly, this is sort of a follow-up to the last podcast that you were on for ClearPath Financial Partners. And now, as people kind of progress through their lives, really, many people have set up trusts. Can you give us first just sort of an overview of what exactly it is that we're talking about when we're talking about a trust?
Yeah, absolutely. So we work with a number of people who they've done the right thing. They've done their estate planning documents during their lifetime. And as part of that, they've established a trust. Most of the time, they're revocable trusts. And the person who established it, they're the trustee during their lifetime. But what then happens is either they become incapacitated, they pass away, and at that point, somebody else needs to be the trustee, and that's usually laid out in the document. And at that point, that person, hopefully they're aware they're the trustee, they've probably never been one before, and there's all kinds of things to be aware of when it comes to that trust. That's why we're here to talk about that today.
Is there some sort of a trustee school that one goes to learn to be a trustee?
There really should be, I think, Hank. That's a great idea. Maybe that, you know.
you can start one.
That could be a business opportunity for somebody listening out there. But yeah, I mean, honestly, I think a lot of it stems from the past, I'd say at least since I've been doing this kind of, you know, career for a couple decades. But even for a couple decades prior to that, there had been this sort of surge in estate planning and people understanding that, especially in states like Massachusetts, where there was an even lower and still is a pretty low estate tax threshold of $1 million and now $2 million, which, I mean, look at the real estate market. A lot of people just with a house and a little life insurance policy or bank account will, you know, could hit those thresholds. So a lot of people set up trusts over the past few decades because they heard it was a great idea, protect their house, protect their assets from the nursing home, from the tax man, from my daughter-in-law if she divorces my son and remarries. I mean, those kind of things. But a lot of them, like Molly said, they start as just revocable, you know, individual or family trust, but those are simple and there's really no separate entity. It's just this estate vehicle that only when they at some point become incapacitated or when they do eventually die, then the whole construct changes and it becomes, in a lot of cases, this irrevocable trust, has its own tax structure. And then really what we're talking about today are the other people who are involved. And in some cases, they're well aware that this duty is forthcoming at some point, right? And in some cases, they have no idea until they get a call from their potentially from their parent or from the lawyer or from somebody to say, hey, you are the trustee. And now all of a sudden they have this host of responsibilities that most people aren't prepared for.
Right. Because Molly, and it's interesting that you, as you talked about this, I guess I had mostly always heard the term, I'm watching TV or whatever, about the irrevocable trust. But that's not the way that most of them are, at least when they start, it sounds like, from what you had to say. When somebody gets that trust, now what is in that trust? Is that all the assets? So it's got cash and it's got more than just cash.
Yeah, so certainly people do still establish irrevocable trust from the get-go. We find it to be less common with most of our clients for the majority of at least their liquid assets. So things like retirement plans, cash, things like that. When you open an irrevocable trust, that's essentially like a lockbox. I mean, you're putting something in there, locking it up, essentially giving away the key, and that's not yours anymore. That's the whole point. So they may do that with things things like their home, right? Their primary residence, could be collectibles, things like that are illiquid and they don't expect to have to spend for income. You know, a lot of them more commonly are these revocable trusts. Can you speak to that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And who wants to do a trust as a, opposed to I just here's just my bank account and here's just my real estate and why it's in a trust?
Yeah, so most people, there is some other catalyst, and Ryan mentioned some of them. It could be a family dynamic where they don't want the kids to inherit everything outright. It could be for protections from estate planning, taxes. We see it a lot when there is something that the person who owns the assets that they want to happen when they die, and they're not going to be here to make sure that gets carried out. And so the trust becomes the entity that holds the assets, and the trustee is in charge of making sure whatever is in that trust document happens for the assets and for the beneficiaries of that trust.
It's interesting to me, and maybe Molly, if you could tell me a little bit more about the trustee. So the trustee gets the trust, but it's really been set out for him, the parameters, by the person who has most likely now passed away. I mean, the trustee can't just kind of come in and say, okay, you get this and you get this and here's my share. This is really set in stone.
Yeah, exactly. So the trust document is, one, really complex, and that's why the job of a trustee is so difficult.
And to Hank, to your point, the owner of that trust originally, they're called the grantor. And you're right. They established the framework very explicitly and as specifically as they want with regard to who the beneficiaries are, how the investment should be managed, how much income is available and to whom, and when something happens to one person, then where does their share go? All of those things are laid out by the grantor prior to this trustee. So the trustee's role is to act in accordance with those wishes.
And then what happens or does it happen? Because you kind of mentioned up when you set this up, Ryan, about, you know, like family dynamics and stuff. I would assume that there are some beneficiaries, and I don't know what the trustee role here would be if it's the grantor who put this all together. But a beneficiary who goes, wait a minute, I feel like my brother or sister maybe is getting more than their fair share.
Absolutely. And we've seen that. And that's where, you know, you have someone who maybe didn't even know they were a trustee. They get appointed and they have no idea what to do. And that can create a massive issue because if they're not properly managing the assets, if they're not communicating with the beneficiaries, beneficiaries can, you know, get an attorney to contest the trustee's actions and prove that either they're not acting as a fiduciary in their best interests, they're not properly keeping records, they're not, you know, maybe properly allocating the assets set up for growth. And that's when the trustee can then be removed and replaced with someone else.
When it comes to that growth, so when someone passes away, they have the trust, someone becomes the, you know, now I'm going to come in and I'm going to be the trustee. Can the trust just continue for a number of years, or does it very often just get distributed right away?
Yep, depending on the trust, Hank, either or, right? Some are distributed, and it's just the time it takes, which could be several months or more typically, to distribute that and dissolve it. Sure. Oftentimes, there are continuity, right? Additional trust, or that trust continues or then has sub-trusts. And in some cases, it's like in perpetuity. So, you know, and Molly talked about all of a sudden there's these responsibilities and, you know, and sometimes it's too much, or if they're not properly equipped, they ultimately will resign. But I think prior to that, they're, you know, even with people who have everything properly in order, there are differences of opinion. So unless it's the most simple case, right? Husband and wife, one child, they get everything, and then they have free reign. Most trusts aren't like that, because if that were the case, they would just leave it outright to that one child. Typically, it's because there are some complexities, or even if they do have one child, they're worried, well, you know, but what if something happens to them? Will, you know, that spouse, again, if they were to get remarried, would the money I put away for my grandkids potentially go to somebody else's kids one day if that were to happen? So I will say it's kind of a thankless task in a lot of ways. It's a massive responsibility. There's huge obligations. So, you know, I think I want Molly to kind of talk through some of those core responsibilities in those challenges. But I will say, even with the best laid plans, in clarity, there's always a bit of emotional element, certainly. There are differences of opinions, and even if everything is perfectly laid out, set in stone, and the trustee acts properly, they're still likely to get questions and, you know, maybe weird dynamics from siblings who feel like, well, why is John the one doing all of these things and making these decisions? John may not be making any decisions. He may be simply carrying out the wishes, but right. It's very easy. And I think any trustee that we have worked with as a client has often echoed this sentiment that it's usually the furthest geographically and least involved beneficiary who has the loudest opinions. Right. And it makes it really tricky.
Molly, you want to follow up on that and give us some of those details then?
Yeah, definitely. So someone who becomes a trustee, and there's a few different ways a trust can be set up. It can be one person acting as the solo trustee. It could be that you've got two kids and you appoint both of them and they're co-trustees. Or in other cases, we've seen, you know, appointing a third party, a professional trustee or a corporate trustee. Regardless of if it's one person, two people, or a corporation, the responsibilities are the same. And they, as Ryan mentioned, they're big. The first one being that you have fiduciary duty, which when people hear the word fiduciary, they tend to think of financial advisors, lawyers, these professional roles that you have an obligation to act in the best interest of, in our case, it's clients, but in the case of the trust, it's the beneficiary. So even if you're not receiving any money from the trust, you still have an obligation to act in the best interest of those beneficiaries. And that can mean properly allocating the funds, making sure they're invested if it's supposed to last through a lifetime, balancing risk, prudent care of the investments to make sure that it lasts.
And you are listening to the podcast of Clear Path Financial Partners, Molly Brown, and talking about trust, Ryan Kittredge here as well, President Financial Advisor for ClearPath Financial Partners. And Ryan, I don't know if there's some things that you might want to jump in on, Molly was just talking about, and follow up on that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I guess with the interest of time, knowing that this is, you know, a podcast and we don't have a time to go in a lot of detail, the fact is that these responsibilities are vast, right? Everything from proper record keeping, administration, making sure paperwork is done, tax filing and reporting, communication, keeping the beneficiaries apprised of changes, rationale, what's being distributed and why, what are the tax implications, all of that. And I would venture to say that the vast majority of people, unless they were highly skilled in, you know, finance and or legal estate planning background, they're usually not equipped on their own to handle all of those responsibilities. So I think a key piece is to make sure you have those right professionals. And the attorneys do a great job of setting these frameworks up and executing on sort of helping with the resolution. But oftentimes there's massive gaps of time between the wishes being set out and then the rubber hitting the road and things happening. Mm. Oftentimes it's years or could be decades later. And you need to have some communication, you know, that's where the folks who set it up, the grantors, right, the clients who are doing trusts, they need to be reviewing them periodically. We're having family discussions, trying to sort of head off those things so that when that day comes and we're working with the trustee and making distributions to the beneficiaries, that like everyone feels as on the same page and about, you know, and as good and confident with the plan as they can, right? And I think that's key.
Molly, should everybody be setting up a trust? Are there disadvantages? Or is it, you know, when you're talking to people at ClearPath Financial Partners, for example, are there people where you're thinking, well, you know, a trust would be a good way for you to go, but others, it might not be the right way for them to do it?
Yeah, it really depends on what their wishes are and, you know, level of assets, but primarily comes down to, you know, is it simple where they've got, as Ryan mentioned, like, two parents, one kid, it's their kid, they want the kid to get everything, may not make sense to have a trust. We see it a lot for blended families that maybe they've got one kid who has some special needs or addiction issues and they want them to get assets, but they want to protect how that happens. So it can be useful for most families.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And you really do have to consider those trade-offs, Hank, because the downside are that there's costs and there's complexities. They add those things, right? So the costs are both explicit in terms of there's additional estate planning document costs, there's additional tax filing costs, but a lot of those costs are not so explicit in there about the time that all of these people have to be involved. And so you need to weigh that out in the decision. It's not as simple as, oh, hey, I pay $3,000 for this trust document and I save $60,000 on estate taxes. There's a lot more to it, and you have to really think through that to determine if it's a good
decision. Well, I got the hardest part to this seems to me to be something that you can't really guarantee, and that is, have I selected the right person to be the trustee? My three children, this is the one who's the most level-headed. I'll have them do it, and then for whatever reason, it doesn't quite gel the way that you thought that it would. I guess that there's just no way to know. I mean, you have to make a decision. You have to pick somebody. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you do, and you do. And there's no perfect choice, right? Because like Molly mentioned, that there's different. It doesn't always have to be an individual. For most people, if there is that person, whether it's a child or a sibling or a niece, nephew, or a best friend who you have as much trust in as you can have in a person, and you feel that they're competent and sort of willing and resilient enough to carry out those duties, because it's kind of tough, right? Especially if you're getting pushback from beneficiaries, especially when it's the case of an addicted child or somebody who's a spendthrift who, you know, has mental illness. That beneficiary is going to try to do everything they can to convince the trustee to give them resources for X, Y, and Z. And it's that trustee's duty to determine, is that actually in their best interest, or is this going to be to their detriment?
Ryan, I'm curious how you and Molly or others in the profession, ClearPath Financial Partners, and please check out more at clearpathfinancialpartners.com, because you'll be advising the person who has set up the trust. Many times, I'm sure the whole family also looks to you to be their financial advisor, and now they're going to be the beneficiaries of the trust, and how you sort of give them advice, and are there some tax implications when they get this trust?
So we act as, you know, like you mentioned, to help the person who's setting it up to understand it. And then, you know, it's typically our client passing away or becoming trustee for a different trust. We tend to act as the guider to connect them to the professionals they need to properly be a trustee. And that means, you know, going back to either the attorney who wrote it or a different estate attorney. Let's interpret the trust. What was meant to happen here? What are the guidelines for income distributions? What are the guidelines for a beneficiary coming to the trustee and asking for money? How are the assets supposed to be invested? And then, do you have a CPA to make sure that the tax returns get filed and the beneficiaries get the tax forms that they need? So we, while we don't do all of those things, we tend to be kind of the hub that coordinates those.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think just one other thing I'd like to add with, you know, regarding the other options is some people, unfortunately, they're like, there's nobody that's the right person, right? They might say, boy, it's just, you know, I have a couple kids and boy, I love them dearly, but you know, one is an artist in California and the other one is a teacher, you know, of physics. Like they don't know anything about, you know, or they're not close enough or understand these things well enough. And so in some cases that can be bridged with other professionals, and in other cases, it really can't. And in those instances, they need to look for a professional trustee, or corporate trustees, or more if you're, I would say, in the ultra high net worth and you have these generational trusts with, you know, many millions of dollars that continue in perpetuity. It's very expensive, but if you have enough assets, it could be worthwhile. But that professional trustee of having your CPA or the attorney who did the draft or their firm act as trustee can help mitigate some of those risks. They will act a bit more pragmatically, perhaps, but it's going to cost more. They may not have the same relationship with your beneficiaries as a personal trustee. The communication may not be quite as good as if it's the brother to the other brother who has challenges and he's, you know, the steward of those assets that the parents left behind, right? So there are all those considerations. It's really a lot, but if there's one takeaway from all of this that we would have people be thinking about, it's yes, the estate planning is important, but don't forget that it's not done when you do the documents, right? That's like the beginning, and then, you know, the titling of accounts and so on. That's just the beginning. The estate planning really happens in, again, some cases, many years down the road and in perpetuity. So you want to make sure you have a design, you know, laid out for what that's going
to
be.
And with that design, Ryan, some of this would seem to me to have overlap with someone's will also. I mean, are there, but a trust is more specific just kind of when it comes to the distribution of the assets, and the will's a little bit broader?
Exactly.
But you have both.
Yep. Yeah, typically, you know, almost we recommend like everybody have a will. Really, almost across the board, very few exceptions. Trusts are more specific, but those who have trusts typically also have wills, really to catch things that don't go into the trust. But if you're doing trust planning, generally one of the goals is to avoid probate and not have assets be intestate and part of your estate. But the will is there to facilitate it, oftentimes acts as a flow through to the trust. So we'll say any residue of the estate should then flow through the trust. So it kind of acts as a catch.
Molly, we have just a couple of minutes left. What else do we need to know about setting up a trust?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not so much on the setting up of it, but what happens when you find out you're a trustee? Like, what do you do? And those things are, number one is just don't be afraid to ask questions of estate attorneys, of financial advisors, reach out for help, establish that communication with the beneficiaries. If you can't read the trust document and figure out who they are, get help for that, and then immediately like establish how you're going to communicate with them. Track everything as to the T, because you until you know what you're supposed to be doing, it's really easy to make errors.
And that's it. And it's like if this lovely responsibility is bestowed upon you one day, you have this fiduciary legal duty, whether you like it or not. So you either better do a great job and check all the boxes, or pass off that responsibility. You don't want to just go in and kind of do it sort of halfway or, you know, as you see fit, because you're likely going to get sued or be massively exposed in several different ways.
Podcast.
Leave it on that happy note.
There
Hank.
You go. Exactly right.
So talk to some professionals so that doesn't happen.
That's it exactly. And where do you go to talk to those professionals? Ryan Kittredge, Molly Brown, ClearPathFinancialPartners.com. By the way, when you go there, you can check out some of our past podcasts as well. Just go to the tab about us. Bring that down. Check out some of the past podcasts for some more great advice from ClearPathFinancialPartners.com.